So, as Roger said, there's some notes. It's like a PDF, like few pages I made yesterday. I hope, it's somehow enlightening. So I'll try to explain what reinforcement learning is today, and it's going to be very, very basic, just because I noticed that most of the time when we talk about machine learning, it's usually supervised learning, sometimes unsupervised learning, but in the physics community, at least, it seems to be almost never reinforcement learning. So I think it would probably be good to have some basic introduction of what finally this Q function is, like that everybody knows from now, like what this object is and what it's not. So I'll try to just explain what reinforcement learning is about. Please stop me, right, whenever you have any question. I'll try to get to like deep reinforcement learning at the end. I might not make it because I've never tried this thing before, so we'll see how far I get. So basically, my goal for today is to browse through the entire book of Sutton and Bartow in 1 hour. Right? Because if I have to get to like the actual algorithm, which is like in chapter number 8 or something, I don't know if I'll make it. So the book to go to actually is Sutton and Bartow. It's MIT Press. And so basically, I think almost everything you want to know about reinforcement learning can be found in this book. The first version, I think, is now like 20 years old or something like this. But there's been recently, I think, a new version, so it's very, very up to date. And so I very often get the question, like, what's the difference between reinforcement learning and unsupervised learning? Or, right, because we all know supervised learning, if I have labels to my data, I basically want to fit some function, right? And so then I'm good. This I understand. And unsupervised learning, I want to learn some distribution maybe, right? Or I want to learn how to cluster something. So why is reinforcement learning not the same as unsupervised learning? So it's not the same as unsupervised learning. And so the basic difference, I think, I want to summarize just like this, is that in both supervised and unsupervised learning, essentially you have data, right? And that data has been given to you at zero cost. You have the data or you don't have the data, and if you don't have the data, you just get more data, right? But you're not taking into account the cost of getting this data. It's not in your objective function. The objective is just to fit the data or to predict something about this data distribution. In reinforcement learning, the recurring theme is basically taking the data is costly. So the whole point of this is taking into account the actual cost associated maybe with taking the data. And so the recurring problem is this so-called exploration versus exploitation dilemma. It's summarized in one very, well, you get it everywhere, but it's summarized essentially in a very simple problem, which is the one I want to start with, which is the so-called K-armed bandit. So imagine you have the following, let's say K. Does everybody know what a bandit is?
No.
No? Yeah. So it took me a long time to figure out that this actually is sort of a slang word referring to a slot machine, right? So a bandit is not just a bandit, right? Someone who robs your money. It's also a slot machine. And a K-armed bandit is not referring to K bandits that are trying to shoot you or something like this. It's referring to a slot machine with K arms you can pull, right? And so now, essentially, imagine you have the following problem. There's K of those slot machines, 1, 2, 3, 4, K of them. And imagine you don't know what the reward of those slot machines is, right? You're in Vegas and you're trying to make money, and there's some reward for those machines, but you don't know what it is. So maybe reward for this one is some distribution of rewards, And there's some average here. Maybe the second one is better. It has some average, some distribution, something like this, right? So all of them are maybe probabilistic machines. They give you some reward, which is probabilistic, but they have some distribution, but you don't know what this distribution is. And so in unsupervised learning, you might want to cluster this thing if you have the data to see if the machines are different or the same. If you want to do it supervised, you might have labels of these machines, and you basically want to have some neural network like output what the average reward would be. But now my goal is different. I've never seen these machines before. And basically, I have to put in money in these machines, and I want to maximize the reward I get, because it's actual money I get back, right, from these machines. So my goal is to optimize the process of like trying out all the machines and optimizing the reward I get. And so you see that this is sort of the minimal example where you see this exploration versus exploitation. It's that basically the exploring comes at a cost that I can't exploit the knowledge I have, right? But if I never explore, then I will always, well, almost certainly be suboptimal, because I will never find out which one of the livers is like the optimal one. And so maybe if I draw as a function of time, sort of the reward I can get as a function of time, clearly for a given set of distributions of slot machines, there is a maximum I can ever get, right? So this is maybe the true maximum I could ever obtain if I ever figure out what the best machine is. And okay, let's say I find some algorithm, right, that tries to figure out which of these machines is the best machine, and then I just play this machine forever. But maybe there's an algorithm that basically doesn't find it at all, right? This is clearly a suboptimal algorithm, and again, that's probably because it's not exploring enough, right? It didn't explore enough to figure out that there was a better machine. And there are algorithms, of course, that guarantee you that you actually get the optimal one. Namely, if I try them all sufficient amount of times, I do statistics on it, then I'm guaranteed that I will figure out which is the best machine, but that might actually take very long, right? So there's maybe this algorithm that might take very long. And so in reinforcement learning or in any type of learning, basically this is the cost. This is sort of your regret that basically you're losing all this money, right, by having an algorithm that's not good enough. And so basically the goal is to do something like this, right? Is to find some algorithm that doesn't only find what the true reward is, but that basically also minimizes this sort of regret, right? And that's a smart algorithm. And so RL is all about that. It's like, how do I balance exploring, which is the thing that will guarantee me to find the optimal, with exploiting, which is what you would say, yeah, if you do gradient descent, for example, you're constantly exploiting local gradient information, but that's not optimal because you can get stuck, so you have to explore, right? And so balancing the two is basically what the problem is about. And so maybe since this is you might think this example is like too trivial to be any interesting, but actually already this example has missions. So for example, not just playing slot machines, but if you think about ad placements, for example, like, so the New York Times, I know for a fact, uses this K-Arm Dandit algorithm to place ads on their website. And you see, the problem is exactly the same. They don't know how much people will click on an ad, right? They only get money if people click on the ad. So they want the highest amount of clicks. So you have to basically probe the people and see, are they baiting, right? Are they clicking the ad? So you have to try many ads and see if they click it. But once you find an ad that's good, you want to use this, right? Because in the end, you have to make money. But yeah, once you're using it, you can't put two ads at the same time, right? So it's exactly the same problem. So like this ad placement, For example, similar problem is the problem you face if you wanna route traffic, let's say on some network, right? Basically, some internet, for example. There's many different routes you can take to basically send data from one node to the other node, right? But the bandwidth of all them is not the same, right? And some might be heavily used at a given time, and others might not be used at all. But you don't know which one has a lower capacity at the moment before you send the packet through this channel, right? So you basically want to probe your channels by sending some packets, but once you figure out a route that's good, you basically want to stick with it. But when do you know there's not a, like, when is the time to stop looking for a better solution? So, like, routing is one problem as well. And so, in this case, it's basically also a good example to start using some notation. So let's try to write something. So I'll try to stick with this Q because it will lead to this Q function in the end. Let's say that the reward I get when I do a certain action, so an action in this K-armed bandit is basically I pull one of the levers of the slot machine, right? Is the expected reward I get. So it's this return, which could be drawn from some distribution like this, conditional on the fact that the action I did was A, right? So I'm doing action A, which is I'm pulling, let's say, this arm, and then I get a certain reward, and basically this function Q of A is basically telling me what's the expected reward. And the thing I want to do, essentially, is just maximize this expected reward, right? So the thing I want to look for in the end, if I have the true Q, if I know the true expected value, the thing I just want to look for is the maximum of Q, right? Because then I maximize my reward. So the action, the arc max of this thing is the optimal action to take. And so now I face, and that's a generic thing, so now I face a problem, right? It's that essentially I have to get an estimate of what this Q of T is, right? That's my issue. Is that if I know the true expected Q, I'm done, right? But now I have to try to get some estimate, and basically the statistics I have from the start is zero. I have zero samples. So how am I going to try to get statistics of this? Well, one way to keep statistics is just to count, right? So you just pull some arms and you keep counting what reward you get. So you just keep a running sum, essentially, of the reward. So let's say Q of T plus 1, I can just write it in principle as some sum of all the rewards I get, right, up to that time t. That's nothing but frequentist's rule, right? You just count something, and that gives you an estimate of the expectation value of something. But now you just do essentially a very simple trick, right? You basically pull the last observation out of this sum, right, which gives you something like r of t. And then, of course, my sum goes over t minus 1 things, right? But t minus 1 thing is exactly this expected Q for the previous time, right? So clearly, I can also just write this as t minus 1 divided by t minus 1 to t minus 1, right, r of I. And so this guy was nothing but Q of T, right? So if I keep stored somewhere this function Q of T, I can just keep adding as a running sum my reward, right? So then, well, basically, what I get is just something very simple, like it is a previous Q of T plus 1 over t, and then I get the difference between the current reward I see and and my expected value, right? And so you see, this 1 over t is just a statistical weight, right, of a sample. If you just try to get an estimate, the only reason we want to get an estimate of this is to get basically some way of maximizing, finding the actions, right? Because the maximum of this function will give me the action. So basically, you can replace this in general by some statistical weight, alpha. You don't have to weight everything exactly the same, right? And this you see, it's basically how surprised you are about the outcome, right? If you really get the expected value, then you're not updating your current estimate. If it's higher, then of course you're increasing it. So this is sort of the surprise factor of the current result. And so, I mean, that's one part which is recurring, and we'll see it will come back in more complicated cases. It's that you have to somehow estimate this value, right? So how much is everything worth? But now at the same time, I have to decide what to do, right? So now that I have some running average of my estimated value, how do I decide what to do? And so the most basic algorithm, and it works surprisingly well in many cases, is called epsilon greedy. And so greedy is essentially it's like gradient descent. Greedy is basically on the average you have right now. So on the current statistical estimate of this Q, you basically do the best thing you can. Right? That's really greedy. So that would be exactly the same as gradient descent, right? You basically do the optimal thing on the estimate. But you see, you will almost certainly get stuck in some suboptimal solution because it had some statistical fluctuation. It seemed better. You keep trying it forever, but you're never exploring anymore. So this epsilon basically just refers to the fact that with probability 1 minus epsilon, you do greedy. You do the optimal thing. And with probability epsilon, you do something random, like completely random. So I can define something which like a policy. It's what do I do? And I say with probability epsilon, basically I do something random. And with probability 1 minus epsilon, I do arc max of q of t. And that's my policy at time t. And now every time I do something, I can update this function. I can do it again, right? And so I basically switch between those two. And so this epsilon is what makes me explore because I'm trying random things. And this argmax is what basically forces me to take something that I think is optimal. And for this algorithm, you can prove that it converges to the optimal result. And that the convergence, so this regret, how slow it goes, it's at most linear in time. So it's basically, it's not bad, right? So, but is that the best you can do? No. So you see what the problem with this algorithm is, even though it's used like widely, is that this step is not very smart, right? You're forcing exploration, but you're not being smart about it because you're just basically doing something completely random. So you might want to be a little bit smarter about what you do to explore, right? And so one algorithm that works on K-arm bandit is so-called, UCB, upper confidence bound. And so it's a very clever algorithm, actually. It's completely deterministic, so that's why I want to put it in. It's completely deterministic, and yet it explores. And the reason it explores is the following. So here we're using our current estimate of the reward to do an action, right? But we all know, I mean, there's fluctuations on this estimate, right? And so why am I using the mean of my current expected mean to do an action? and so that's where this upper confidence bound come from. If I feel very confident, I can actually estimate, given the number of samples I have, what's the probability that actually I'm underestimating the true mean by a certain value, right? And that's just, you can get it from Chernoff bound or whatever you want to say, right? So I have a certain Q of t, and I'm just asking what's the probability that I underestimate this, that I'm underestimating the true, I should have used different notation, let's do this. True Q of t by a certain value delta. And so we know that's actually decaying something like delta squared n, right? Where n is the number of samples you have. I guess there's a 2. And so you see, this goes down exponentially in the number of samples you take. And this is what you use to compute the upper confidence bound on some given sample mean, right? And so now, if you feel confident that you want to be risky, then basically you can use the upper confidence bound as your current estimate for how much you will get, right? And it's very, most likely you won't get that, but it's like the highest reward you can statistically still get, right, with a reasonable chance. And so if you do this, then basically it leads to something like, let me use some different notation. Let me just say what the action is. So the action for this UCB is basically you take still the arc max. You don't take it of the current Q of t, but you add to this delta that's still reasonable, right? And so this actually, there's some constant, which is some hyperparameter you can pick. It's just how unlikely do you still want this thing to be, right? And then there's square root of something like log of t, where t is how long you have been trying, right? Divided by the number of times you have seen, you have used this action already. And so now you see where the balance between exploration and exploitation in this upper confidence bound comes from. It's that if I never take action A, I basically get 0 here, right? I have 0 samples. But that means for my upper confidence bound is infinite because I have no statistics. So if I'm willing to make bets, then I'm going to say, I have to bet on this because it could be gigantic. But on the other hand, because this is decaying exponentially, the numerator here is only growing logarithmically with time. So it does take a little bit of time before you start to see this. And so it's basically this pressure coming from log of t growing. And then if you don't do any new statistics, basically at some point you will realize that you need more statistics to be certain of this. And so for this problem, this works extremely well. Yes?
What if I'm in at a deep minimum that might have a free energy to get out of it if this were a glass problem or some other? And I find a curvature, like you're telling about, and it always keeps me in this, and I never explore to find out if there are other...
Yes. No, so actually, that's the nice thing. Maybe I should have stressed that in the beginning. So another way in which I would say is a defining property of reinforcement learning is that there's no gradients. Literally, the local landscape is irrelevant. So it's really because I'm never computing any gradient, right? I'm never asking, if I make a slight change in what I'm doing, what's the change in the outcome? No, I'm just trying outcomes, right? And keeping statistics of the full outcome. And so I'm not limited by something which is like the local gradient or the local curvature or something like this, because I'm
see the box didn't limit you with much.
No, because this is still dependent on this policy pi, right? And so it's really this policy that's limiting me. It's the things I try, right? And of course this estimate will depend on what I try, right? And if I set this epsilon to 0, if I always try the best thing, then of course I will be stuck, right? Because once I find something that's good, I will keep doing it, and I'm basically digging my own hole, right? I will never get out of it anymore. So everything is in this policy pie. That's the thing you have to pick properly. And so this is one policy. This is another one, right? And basically that one's stochastic, right? I take, there's some randomness to the thing I do. This one is completely deterministic, but it's not, it's changing with time, right? It's changing with how long I'm doing things. And so the policy I'm using knows about the uncertainty in my estimates. And once they become too big, it's gonna immediately tell me to just try the ones which are very uncertain. And so the last thing, so is the one I kept it for last, is the one that.
So what was the justification for the log T?
So the log T is just, the justification basically comes from the fact that in the end you want this probability to go to zero, right? And so as long as you say that I want this probability to go to basically, well, you can also get that. You can never go to this line faster than some power law in the end. And so if you want this probability to go to zero as some power of time, then whatever this power is, if you compute what this delta is, it's going to be log of some time. And then this power you can absorb in C. So that's just it. It's basically the fact that this probability, you want to shrink the probability of not knowing the mean to zero in some reasonable way with time. And so the last one is basically what we would do, I think, physics, is that the problem with this greedy or epsilon greedy is that you're doing random things when for epsilon times. But why would you do random things if you have some estimate of what the value of given actions are? US 101 South Las Casitas
Road, Santa Barbara. Or not.
So another way to get a policy, which is what do I do, let's say at time t, is to just weigh to take them with a given probability, but given that you have some idea about what the reward will be, you can basically softmax those things, right? And so that's basically we would do like, oh, I just do this, right? Now I'm essentially important sampling, or whatever name you want to give this. I'm sampling from some distribution, and this distribution is weighing things which have a high reward. It's making them more likely than things with a lower reward. And so you can basically try to Gibbs sample out of the current estimate of Q. And if you're smart about how you keep the rewards, basically if you wouldn't average them but just keep counting them, right, then it becomes an extensive quantity with time, right, because you're just adding them up. Then you could say it's like you're automatically lowering the temperature of this thing, and so it's like annealing itself. In the end, it goes to like you only do the best thing automatically. So this is very good, but this is costly, right? So I mean, that's sort of what reinforcement learning is. And so now I think we'll get into some. I mean, this is the most basic example where essentially what you get is that there's certain rewards, and these rewards I get, they depend on what I do, but they don't depend on any state variable or any hidden variable. Every time I go back to the slot machine and I do it again, I get the same reward, right? The internal state of the slot machines is not changing with time. But if I think about any complex problem like playing chess or playing Go or maneuvering some car through a city, clearly what I do now depends on the state where I'm at, right? So we have to introduce some slightly more complicated version of this, which basically just leads to a Markov decision process. That's basically the more complicated version of the KRM bandit is that I have some agent, just like there, right? There's some environment, which could be like the slot machines. I'm doing some action at time t on this environment, and I'm getting back some reward. Right? The additional thing in general is that there's also a state, right? There's also a state that tells me, yeah, what is the state of this environment? This agent might not know it, but hypothetically it should be there, right? And so it doesn't mean that the agent fully controls this state, but it has its action has some implication on maybe this hidden state of the environment. And so all the rest of RL is basically how do we deal with this thing. So still, how do we maximize rewards for processes like this? And so what we want to define again is the total rewards we will get if we keep doing certain actions on a given environment and we're getting back certain rewards. What is the total reward we will get? But I'm not just, so now, since my system depends on time and on some internal state, right, my reward isn't always the same. So when I did this, I keep pulling this arm, I was getting the same reward drawn from the same distribution. But now in general, my reward will change. It depends on what time is. And I might not get an immediate reward for something I do, but the reward might come like much later, right? And so again, think in terms of a game. If I play chess, and maybe these states are the all possible combinations of pieces on a chessboard, I do an action which is basically a move on my chessboard, then there's no immediate reward for this move, right? The reward is basically just at the end, will I win the game or will I lose the game? So I have to keep playing for a long time until I see this reward. So I won't be interested in exactly the reward. I will be interested in the cumulative reward, right? What's the total reward I will get if I do this for a very long time? So it's not just the reward now, but it's also the reward maybe later when I do something new, and so on and so forth, right? And to make life a little simple, the thing you can do is basically rewards in the future, well, you can put this to one if you want to, but in general, rewards in the future, you have to discount. There's some discount for having a reward in the future. And the simplest example you can take is exactly for stock markets, for example. There's some reward if you invest money in something, which is once you sell it, you'll get a little bit, you get hopefully more money out. But you have to discount this. Because you can just basically buy some stocks from Germany, for example, which is probably one of the safest thing you can do. There's a given interest rate on those stocks, but if you only are making exactly this amount of money, then there's no reason why you would ever take risk, right? So this is like in finance, you would say it's like you're discounting for the risk-free investment rate, right? And so in general, you could always say like, oh, it's because things in the future might be a little bit more uncertain, so I don't want to infinitely account for the future. And so this gamma is some number between 0 and 1, and depending on what problem you're dealing with, it's either very close to 1 or it's very close to 0 maybe. Okay, so that's my goal. I want to basically maximize this thing. And so now I have to set up the math of the problem, right? So we usually just draw this diagram. But what's this diagram basically representing? Well, if I want to like turn it into some formula, I have to specify what this thing does. Right? And so we will say that all of these things are basically just some Markov process. And so this action A, basically I can always say, and that's why I was using this policy, there's a policy for drawing actions. Given the current state of the agent, it can draw a certain action with a probability, conditional probability A, given that it was in state S. Right? And at the same time, I can say that this whole thing is also some transition matrix where basically I say that there's a probability of going to a new state S prime, getting a certain reward R, conditional on the fact that I took action A and that I started in state S. Right? Pretty simple. So once I have these two objects, I can basically write down, well, how will I formally get the optimal solution for drawing these actions, right? And so this will lead, I hope at least I'll properly explain that. This will lead to so-called Bellman's theorem or Bellman's equation. So how will we do this? Well, instead of looking directly at g of t, which is sort of a scalar value that tells me what the reward is, it's actually, as sometimes is the case, it's nice to look at a more complicated object first and then reduce the problem afterwards. And so the reason I'm saying that this will lead to Bellman's equation is that we do exactly the same sometimes in classical mechanics, right? So if we would do classical mechanics, we almost always solve classical mechanics by just solving Hamilton's equations, right? Because that is very simple. You give me the initial conditions, I just solve some ODEs and I propagate it in time. This is very simple. This is just some running sum I have to do. It's very simple to compute. But it doesn't allow me to solve certain problems. And the one problem that is very hard to solve if you do Newtonian mechanics is the so-called brachistochron problem. It's the problem of finding what's the optimal curve or the minimal time required to do a certain thing, right? This, the one method that's extremely good in solving this brachistochron problem, that's actually how you would always solve it, is by solving Hamilton-Jacobi equations, right? But you see, you almost never want to solve Hamilton-Jacobi equations because they are fields that live on phase space. It's gigantically more complicated to solve this partial differential equation for the action than to solve just ordinary differential equations for the trajectories. But that's exactly the game we will play. We will exactly say, this is very easy in principle to compute, but let me take a step back because I want to solve some harder problem, which is the optimal control problem of this, let's say, Markov chain. And in order to do so, I have to first involve some more complex function. And so this function is essentially the generalization of this guy. It's the Q function or the value function. And so it's just this. It's conditional on a policy. And it tells me for a certain action and a certain state, what is its value? So what's the value of an action and a state? So it's this g of t, right? But it's the expectation value of g of t conditional on the fact that at time t, I am in state S and I take action A. And you see, by conditioning my sum, I'm getting a much more complex object, but it's actually this thing that will allow me to efficiently solve my RL problem. There's a second function, which is called the value function. It's basically the same, but only conditioned on the state. And so this, if you think in terms of Hamilton-Jacobi equations, this would be the action, right? And so now it's our value function. And so instead of having dynamics which is Newtonian, we now have dynamics which is a Markov chain, right? So instead of getting Hamilton-Jacobi equations, we will get something that looks like it, but will contain these transition matrix elements, right? Okay. Am I going too slow, or? Okay. So, let's write down what this value function is, right? So, in the end, what I want to do is just substitute this expression in here, and then propagate it back using this transition matrix element. So its expectation value of sum of gamma to the power k rt plus 1 plus k, right, conditioned on st is s and action is a. And so now I do exactly the same as before. I just pull one thing out of the sum, right, plus gamma k rt plus 2 plus k, still conditioned on exactly the same thing, right? A of t is A, S of t is S. And so now, this expectation value we can compute, right? Because it's what is the reward I get conditional on the at time t plus 1, so exactly now, when I take action A and I start in state S. Well, that's nothing but actually conditional on A of t, S of t is S, is nothing but, well, it's the sum over all the possible rewards, right? The reward I get, the probability that I got this reward, that I moved to S prime, that I got the reward, that I started in S, and then I took action A, right? That's exactly this probability, because I conditioned it on exactly those variables. Let me remove this condition. Because I'm doing it for the value function. So if I do it for the value function, then I'm not conditioning on the action A, right? Well, that's very simple, because I know I have a given policy, right? So there is a conditional probability of doing A given S. And then I just sum over all A, right? Pretty simple. And so if I use this, I can actually write this value function for a given policy in the following way. It's just sum over all the actions A. This policy I'm using, sum over all the places where I can end up, all the rewards I could get, the probability of doing that, and yeah, this is actually, again, right, the value function of another state, right? So this is the value function of the next state. And so that's it. This is Bellman's equation, or Hamilton-Jacobi equation, if you would write it down for a continuous time Hamiltonian problem. And if you solve this for a given policy, your problem is done, right? If you solve this problem for a given policy, you solve full RL. Because once you have this value function, you just have to find what's the best policy, right? So the whole rest of the problem is dealing with three problems, I would say. One problem is how to solve this thing, right? How do you solve this equation? The second thing is, once you've solved it, how do you find better policies? Because this is for a given policy. The third thing is, how do you deal with even storing this thing, right? Because this is the value, it's a function that lives on the state space. For a given policy, it's a function on the set of all states. And so you have to somehow store this thing, right? And that's where deep learning comes in. So the reason deep Q learning or any deep reinforcement learning is there and works very well is because you have to deal just with storing some function on a very high dimensional space. Okay. So basically, once you have this value function or the Q function, then you can basically just figure out what the optimal thing to do is by taking just again, just like here, you can just show that the best thing to do is take the best action given the Q function. But now the Q function is conditional on a policy, so it's only true if you do it for the optimal policy, right? And so that's the sort of self-consistent argument you can already see coming is that basically I have to pick a policy, estimate this thing, compute it, and then check if I want to update my policy, right? And so basically one way of doing it, so that's what I say what dynamic programming is doing, right? Basically you fix a policy, you try to compute this thing by just running through all the states. I mean, the way you would solve it, in principle, it's a nonlinear set of equations, right? Because this, right, if I write this as a function on this state space, there's like this function, there's a sum, so this is like a matrix thing, right? But it's a nonlinear problem. So you have to solve some nonlinear equations. And the way you usually solve them is by iteration, right? So what you do is you get some estimate of what the value is, you plug it back in, you can multiply this whole thing, you get a new estimate, and you keep iterating this. But this can take extremely long because you see this, it has this Markov matrix in the middle. And so if you want a convergent result, it can never converge faster than the gap in the Markov chain, which typically is extremely small for interesting problems. So you don't want to iterate this forever, right? Because you'll basically never get the solution.
So typical reinforcement learning problems, are you always continually trying to optimize the policy or update the policy?
No.
Because typically you're done at some point. You have the policy, right?
Yes, and no. So I'll get... No, so there is a very neat trick. The point is, so this is how you would, in principle, solve it. But actually, there's a way. So this, I would say, is what's called, it's on policy methods. It's basically, you fix a policy, you compute this thing, and then you check if there's a better policy. And at some point, of course, your criterion will be, there is no better policy, and I stopped doing it, right? I found the best thing. But this means in the previous sort of discussion that the thing you're using for exploration, right? This computing this you can think of for a given policy is like the exploration you're doing. You're using the same policy to explore than the policy you're using to exploit, right? And the neat thing is that actually, and that's the next thing where Q-learning comes from, is that there's a way to use a different policy for exploring but learn the optimal policy at the same time. And that's what's called off-policy methods. And that's, I think, really the breakthrough in RL in the 90s, is that it's this. It's that you don't have to look for all these policies and keep doing it, but you can use a policy that just guarantees you that you explore the space, but at the same time, learn the optimal policy. And so, okay, since I'm mentioning it, let me try to make that point. So this is how you would, let's say, solve it. That's dynamic programming. Basically, you do iteration between finding this value function and updating the policy, right? And now you can say there's a billion tricks, right? Because you could say like, oh, but I don't have to iterate this forever, right? Because I have the wrong policy anyway. So maybe I just iterate it once, change my policy, iterate it again, do it like this, right? And that has a name, it's called value iteration. Basically, you do one update, you change the policy, one update, change the policy. That also works. But still, there's something better. And that's called, and I think that's sort of the breakthrough that happened is it's called temporal difference learning. And so what you do in temporal difference learning is you somehow have to keep an estimate of this, right? And one way of doing it, as I said, is by iteration. But another way of doing it is just by brute force Monte Carlo, right? And there's a whole scheme of just estimating this by Monte Carlo, not using this Bellman equation whatsoever, right? If you would estimate it with Monte Carlo, you would basically just do something like this. Oh, that's exactly what I just erased. But you would basically do this, right? You just keep a running sum of what your estimate is. So you go back to the thing I said in the beginning, we first want to do something more complicated. You just do this if you do Monte Carlo, right? So there's some weight for your samples. There's some estimate you get from Monte Carlo from this. And you subtract the value, right? So this alpha is some hyperparameter. If the weight is all the same, that was this 1 over t here. So that's the most basic type of Monte Carlo you could do. So now what's temporal difference learning? It uses an insight that comes from here. It's basically that instead of computing this g of t, I know I can pull back g of t one step in time, because g of t itself depends on v of t plus 1. Right? That's exactly what I used here to write down Bellman's equation. So if instead of using this, which you can do, so this is like a whole bunch of Monte Carlo methods that exactly do this, you do something slightly different, and you get your estimate from doing this. Which is, I just did exactly the same thing as I did there, right? I'm not using g of t itself. I'm shifting this sum of in my estimate for the total reward by one step. Then I can write it as the immediate reward I get, plus another value function that I already had estimated. And so now you see where the name comes from. This is temporal difference, because I'm computing this difference of the current estimates of the value functions over time. And so this is temporal difference 0, because you can see I can play this game. I can pull this sum for n steps, right? And then I have an n step temporal difference that I'm putting in here. And
where you have to store n value functions?
Well, so you don't have to, you just store this guy. Well, you have to store the update and the current one at the same time. So you do have to have a copy of, yeah. Yeah, and so almost no one does this. Well, I mean, this n step thing is very costly, but you can prove actually that if you have a discount factor gamma, your estimate if you do this for n steps is gamma to the power n times more accurate. So you get a more accurate estimate by doing this for n times, but it comes at a huge cost, right?
Could you just make t another parameter to your value function? Like, could you just have it be a function of s and t?
So in some cases, yeah, you can have t to be also a parameter. I still have some time, so I'll exactly tell you. If you don't want to store this thing but want to store an approximation, like in neural network, there's exactly a way of never doing this and then fitting it, but just learning the parameters of the network there. And that's also possible just because of this rule, actually. Yeah. And this works much better for a good reason, actually, is that if you think about how you're getting estimates here, your estimate of the value function from a Monte Carlo sample is really the sample average in your Monte Carlo, right? If I do Monte Carlo on this and I ask how accurate do I know, well, what is this? My estimate of the real value is just the average of my Monte Carlo data, right? But that's not what I'm after. I'm after the true estimate, right? So it's about, like, am I generating the estimate I want? And so you can prove, of course, that these Monte Carlo methods are very good, but they're just estimating the in-sample value. But I want the true value. And so what this temporal difference learning does, it's basically you can show it's not learning the value function of that sample you took. It's learning the value function of the maximum likelihood Markov chain that you estimate from the data that corresponds to the process, right? Because you don't, if you do this a few times, you wouldn't really know what the Markov chain is. But you get some trajectories, right? And so this is learning what the value is corresponding to the maximum likelihood reconstruction of the Markov chain. And that's actually a much better estimate for the value than just the Monte Carlo sampled value. And so that's why this works so much better. And so now the only other step we have to do is that if we don't do this on the value function, but do the whole discussion for the Q function, I can also do temporal difference learning on the Q function, right? And this last thing is what exactly allows to solve, let's say, Roger's problem. Is that when I'm doing this, I'm still doing it for a given policy. Right, when I stopped writing the pi for policy, but all these value functions, whether I do this or that, they all depend on the policy. But in the end, the only thing I'm after is the optimal policy. And so now, once you do it on the Q function, there is some trick you can do. It's that if you do temporal difference learning, you're doing it for a given policy, right? But actually, this, remember, was just the expected reward. And I pulled back this expected reward one step by shifting the sum. But no one is telling me that I have to use my policy to estimate the Q function of my next step, right? I have to use the policy to estimate, well, for these guys, but no one told me that I have to use the same estimate for that Q function. And so Q learning is nothing but sneaking in here the fact that you're not using this. Once you put here, you don't put the policy you're using there, you're taking the optimal policy. So you're saying that here I put arc max of A. That is, given my current estimate of the Q function, I'm going to say that once I go one step back, I'm going to always take the optimal action for my current estimate of the Q function. And then you can prove, actually, that this thing asymptotically converges not to the Q function of the policy you're using, but to the optimal Q function. So this is converging to the optimal Q. So the Q which solves Bellman's equation. So the optimal one, not to the one you're using to explore. With the only caveat that you can only prove it if you visit all actions and states, right? So it has to be your Markov process has to be ergodic, otherwise you can't prove it, of course. And so there's some efficiency, of course, in how you do this exploration still, right? If you're having some dumb policy to try to estimate this, it's going to take very long to get a good estimate. But so that's sort of... Now, when you see Q-learning, that's literally what it is. You're using temporal difference learning, and because you do it, so that's why you want to use the Q function and not the value function, because this is what allows you to sneak in the action, a different action for the policy, and a different action for your estimate of what's going to happen in the future. And there's all kinds of modifications for this. And so I think the only thing I still want to maybe quickly say is that I didn't discuss any sort of deep learning, but it's fairly trivial, actually, how that works. If you want to do deep Q learning, the only thing you have to ask yourself is that, oh, what's the deep doing, right? The deep is just... there to store policies or Q functions or value functions, right? So essentially what I'm doing is that I'm trying to I have some cost function, which is just quadratic, to minimize the difference, let's do it on the value function for simplicity, to minimize there's some true value function, and there's my neural network value function, which has some hyperparameters, from my neural network, let's say theta of mu or something like that, squared, right? And now essentially I want to fit this, and if I do gradient descent, then I get something like, I get an equation for all my hyperparameters, right, if I follow the gradient, which will be something like times the whatever learning rate and the gradient of this, let's say mu, and this is v of pi minus v as theta, right? That's if I do gradient descent. But now you see this, you can just replace with this, right? And then you can immediately learn the parameters, because instead of having updates that are updating the q function, you're essentially just pulling back, or the value function, you're pulling them back to updates on the parameters, right? Because essentially they're just modifying the gradient. So if in every step you already had, you started from something trivial, which had like the q function was all the same, you knew the parameters, now you do one update, you don't really have to do this update, you immediately do it on the parameters, and the reason you can do it is because of backpropagation, right? Because you can write gradient descent on your cost function, which is fitting the function, and then the only thing you have to do is basically use this as an estimate of the gradient, and then you find a neural network representation of this q function. And then you're done, right? Then you solved all the problems, because now you can store it, you can learn it, and you don't have to try all policies, because you can use a policy that's just somehow efficient in exploring, but learn the optimal one at the same time. And so that's why Q-learning is solving all our problems, like playing Go and stuff like this. And I put some example in the PDF, which is like, so if anyone thinks this is new, it's not. It's kind of old. So I mean, the real breakthrough, I think, was somewhere in 92 or 95 when this thing, so TD Gammon, which was a temporal difference learning program to solve backgammon, it used exactly this. It just said it used a neural network which had like two layers. Well, one layer and then one next to classify it. So it was already used in, let's say, 95, and actually that was at that point beating everybody. So just like in Go, it already existed then. It's just that now the computing power has increased exponentially, so we don't have to solve simple problems like backgammon, but we can do more complex ones just because we can store more, more high-dimensional functions.
So you think the computing power increase is
more, it's more important than the algorithm?
More important than the depth of the neural network?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I mean, they couldn't do big like deeper networks in 95, because I mean they probably couldn't even train them. But computing power is just a gigantic factor, right, in these problems. Because this whole algorithmic scheme, I mean, there's lots of fine-tuning to this AlphaGo. I mean, they do lots of other bells and whistles on this, but this algorithm existed in 95, so it's mostly, I think, computing power. I don't know if there's anything else I wanted to say. If anyone has questions.
I'm just curious about, like, what are the like most urgent like frontiers or challenges in this topic? Like, are there some really simple problems that should be solvable by this and just people can't and it's sort of stuck on, or is it?
So one thing here I didn't stress is actually, so you can wonder from the beginning when I started discussing is that, oh, why isn't this the same as genetic algorithms, right? Sounds like sort of the same. The big difference is this, right? It's that in genetic algorithms, they are extremely good, but they don't associate a value to an internal state, right? They only associate value to the whole process, right? And so, which is a good thing, because sometimes if you want to navigate some labyrinth or something like this, what do I care if I get close to the to the end? if I don't get out, I don't get out. But the problem with that is that then you cannot use internal information to generalize. And so I think still in RL, it works. But if your reward is really in the long run, like it's very far away and there's almost no local reward, so this sum is basically zero apart from something very far away, then it becomes very challenging to make it work. And so it does still work, but it is even more computationally expensive. And I mean, one example is just the thing we did is if you do state preparation or optimal control on something, I don't care about getting close at intermediate times. I only want to get close at the end. And so it does work, but the funny thing is that it starts forgetting what it learned. So this, I think that's sort of a problem. And in AlphaGo, they solved it using like replays. So basically, you remind the machine over again that there was something better. Just because here still, if you do temporal difference learning, you're using a policy to estimate this thing, right? But the best thing to do would be that this policy somehow also converges through the best thing to do, because otherwise you're updating the Q function in some region in phase space where you never want to be. And so that seems to be some problem that's happening, is that you somehow it wanders away from where it wants to be. But aside from that, yeah, I don't know. There's no direct easy problems, I think, to solve. Yes?
So it sounds a little bit like for these difficult problems where reward is significantly delayed, there is some art that has to go into massaging the problem into this form where
yes.
You assign a reward to a state. So is there some rational way of doing it, or you just consult the masters of the game?
I mean, yeah. So there is some art in picking this reward, as Evert also said yesterday, right? In principle, you could always pick the reward to just be this, right? If I win it, I get one. If I lose it, I get zero. Even if this is delayed for extremely long time. That's a very fair reward. It's just that you will need gigantic statistics to do it, and you might want to bias your sampling towards something that makes locally more sense. And then I think it's only heuristics. I mean, it's like in physics. So I can tell you the example where let's say you want to go from one quantum state to some other quantum state. I mean, maybe I want to do it adiabatically so I can put some local cost, which is like how much energy fluctuations I'm inducing. Then it works very well, but it never learns that actually it is sometimes optimal to generate huge fluctuations and then use them later on. And so the reward clearly influences the actual result, and in some cases it's not clear how to pick it. That's a fair, yeah. That I think might be one of the biggest problems, is that if the reward is clear, it's okay, but then it's not always clear. Yes.
So for something like Go or chess, what is the method of choosing the?
So they basically just choose the fact whether you win or lose.
Okay, and then just do the giant statistics.
This is true. I think that it's like a quite
complex
part of the algorithm where they evaluate the value of
yes.
every configuration.
But they,
like,
yeah, yeah, but that's the thing. Yeah, but they do it. So this value evaluation is basically, well, in AlphaGo, it's basically backpropagating all possible moves for a certain depth that you could do given the current value of the state.
That's not all possible ones. I mean, they really have strategy about cutting the tree. Or
yes, exactly. Moves. But that's all based on, so that's the thing, right? It's all still based on what you believe the current value of certain moves is. So they decide what to keep and what not to keep based on exactly, it's a generalization of this rule to larger depths, essentially. That's what they do. But it is, yeah, so that's exactly what they do. They propagate it back, not for one step, but for longer steps. And you get like a tree, and then they decide based on the values they meet in this tree, whether to not explore this branch of the tree anymore. But that's why I was saying, The only reason they can also do this, it's they do it efficiently, but still it's extremely computationally intensive. I mean, I put some plot at the end of the note because now they claim like the new AlphaGo Zero or something they call it, right?
Alpha Zero.
It's like, it's so much better even than when they trained on like on human against humans, right? So they're like, it learns even better strategies, but it's also using, I don't know, 100 times more computational power to do the same. So it's like, yeah. I don't know if it's a fair comparison. It works better, but you used 100 times the compute. But yeah, there's lots of additional bells and whistles. You can't cheat in the end. Right.
More questions? No? Maybe we should end there on slide 3. So, thanks.